Our next presentation is sponsored by the Mormon Transhumanist Association as technology accelerates cultural upheaval. Mormon transhumanists champion prophetic visions of our human potential. Okay, just basic rules. Kill all your cell phones. Be respectful during the presentation. It's being recorded. You'll be able to purchase it after the presentation at the registration desk. And it's 60 minutes long, so that's about it. As far as the panelists, if you guys just want to introduce yourselves when you start. You know more about yourselves than I do. I don't want to read all this. I'm going to give you more time. Okay?
So I'll just introduce the panel and what we're talking about. This is the near and distant future of faith. And traditional forms of faith drawing on divine authority claims, doctrinal certitudes, resistance to science, and detachment from the world are showing their wear. In the near term, if faith is to survive to rising generations in a meaningful way, it will likely need to be constituted differently and draw its claim to authority and vitality from transformed and renewed sources. In the future, when humans have evolved beyond present conditions or have realized visions such as a renewed world, immortality, and eternal life, and spoiler, these aren't just religious visions anymore, traditional religious norms will have run their course. This session draws on Mormon and transhumanist themes to make portraits of near and distant futures of enduring faith. So the three of us will each give a presentation, kind of a portrait, to give a more full-blooded representation of what Mormon transhumanism looks like, what are some possible visions of the future of faith. We'll start with Michael Ann, who is the CEO of the Mormon Transhumanist Association. And I don't know if you want to give, I don't have your bio here. So you can go for it here. All right. Thank you.
Hi. So I'm the CEO of this organization, and my career has been pretty devoted to nonprofit work, specifically community development, nonprofit work through United Way. And I'm pretty deeply religious, and what that means for me is that I'm at my LDS ward every so often, and I'm at an Episcopal church called St. Mary's in Provo more often, and they also do a lot of Eastern practices, mindfulness, that kind of thing. And the presentation I have for you today, I want to rethink some of the traditional symbols of what happens in Christianity. And I want to give us a new way of thinking about what it means to be Christian and how Christianity is incredibly relevant and incredibly poignant for some of the biggest issues that we're facing in a society. So I'll start. I'll start by saying that lately redemption has been a really tricky thing for me to understand. And I wonder a lot what it is exactly that I'm supposed to need redemption from. And what does it feel like to be redeemed? And in what ways am I supposed to redeem myself? Or in what ways am I, you know, reliant on a all-powerful deity to intervene for me in the way of the crucifixion? Is my redemption, is it personal for mistakes that I have made and for things that I have left undone? Or is it supposed to be more collective, right, for my people, for the ways that we think together? And even more, like, to the point, I ask myself a lot, like, I just don't really understand how it is that the death of one random Jewish man in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago is supposed to play a role in me in 2019 being redeemed, right? And, like, honestly, the longer I think about this, the more baffling I find it. And the thing that I find most baffling of all is this really specific way in which he died that's supposed to also be cosmic, by which I mean the crucifixion, right? Because two millennia of Christianity, we've sort of become inoculated against the fact that, like, this is just a really weird thing to think about the crucifixion as the defining symbol for our redemption, whether we're talking personal or collective. We're taught that his suffering was somehow universal, and the extremity of his suffering, like how bad it was, you know, is like the proof that he can feel everything that human beings feel. If we're looking at this theologically, right, like there's no way that like, so like if we're assuming that he is the Son of God the way we've been taught to believe in Christianity, the crucifixion can't be accidental, right? Like this man's birth, his life, his death were foretold for thousands of years. Every detail was planned down to where he was born and what his mother's name was. So it must mean then that his, that like the way in which he died has a meaning, right? It has a purpose, that it has some kind of theological significance. But the more I think about it, I just can't. I don't understand, like, why a cross, like, why crucifixion, right? But as I take a step back, I find another aspect of the story of Jesus that's also kind of specific, kind of time-bound, and yet is also supposedly very full of meaning. And that is the Christian communion, or if you're LDS, if you're Mormon, we call it the sacrament. This is the moment when Christ breaks bread and he shares wine with his apostles shortly before being taken by the Jewish leadership. These two symbols, the taking of communion and the dying on the cross, they're arguably, I think probably conclusively, the two greatest, most universal symbols of Christianity. Even though we have all kinds of disagreements about what it means to be Christian, virtually every Christian has some element of the cross, crucifixion, and some version of the sacrament. These are the two moments that every sect, every denomination must incorporate into their theology, must return to again and again for insight and for purpose and for meaning. And so you're here today to hear about Mormon transhumanists, and we are another iteration in this ever-branching story of Christianity. And I want to tell you how, as a Mormon transhumanist, I kind of incorporate, I wrestle with, and I try to understand what these two symbols mean theologically and for myself personally. Here's the thing about transhumanism. So transhumanism, I don't know how much of you have been to any of the sessions already. Transhumanism is this idea, right, that we can use technology to improve our human condition, right? Like even my eyeglasses are a transhumanist thing, right? I'm using something that I made, that someone made with their hands, in order to improve my natural weaknesses. And so transhumanism, you know, it's about technology. It's also a story about the methods that human beings use to accomplish our ends. It's a story about the history of mankind and what we're pursuing, like the kind of technology that we chase, whether that's, you know, DNA editing or, you know, nuclear bombs or, you know, medicine and surgery. It's a story about what we have inherited and a story that looks to our past to predict our future. And since I'm a Christian transhumanist, not just a secular transhumanist, there's got to be a lesson to be learned from this weird and wonderful and miraculous history of Jesus Christ slain and risen again. And I want to tell you what I personally think that lesson is, and I'm going to tell it to you as a story about how these two technologies, the crucifixion and the communion, came to be. It's a technological reinterpretation of the end of Jesus' life, a transhumanist morality tale about the choices that humanity made long before Christ came to earth. First, the baking of bread, or the making of bread. The making of bread is a wonder of technology, one of the most generous gifts of inheritance and collective creation that I can possibly imagine, because it's, you know, it's one of the oldest foods that humankind has ever eaten. In fact, it's about, they estimate, 30,000 years old. We've been eating bread for 30,000 years. They found evidence of starch on rocks that my ancestors in Europe probably pounded plants into some kind of flour and placed it over a fire. 8,000 years later, in the Neolithic era, agriculture became ubiquitous, and it allowed us to put down roots, to invent sickle blades, grinding stones. It's ancient. There's a sickle blade. There's a grinding stone. Staying put in one place, as opposed to being a hunter-gatherer, meant that your dough could be left out to attract yeast spores, which meant you'd have dough that rises. So I say it's 30,000 years old. Bread as we know it today is about 12,000 years old. That's still really long. This brief history does not begin to touch upon the wonders of the invention of fire for baking, which is a technology, or bricks for making ovens, or beer to skim for yeast, which is how the Gauls made bread. Bread has been the staple for billions of people in history, and it's one of our best means of survival and adaptation. It's a culmination of inventions and technology that is no less transformative or powerful than the Gutenberg press, the automobile, or penicillin. Bread is filling, it's useful, it's easily transported, and it's increasingly cheaply made. Thus, in the Gospels, when Jesus breaks bread and says, "Take and eat, this is my body given for you," what he is saying is no less than take and eat of a miracle. You do not have to be a believing Christian to find wonder and beauty in this deceptively simple act of one man giving another a piece of bread. You only have to be a transhumanist. Bread and the sharing of bread is a symbol of everything that our ancestors sought for, strived for, and a testament to our endurance as a species. But let's return for a moment to the question that I began with, which is the question of the meaning of the crucifixion. The main argument that I hear from other Christians, including Latter-day Saints and Mormons, is that the crucifixion, it's got meaning because it was so gruesome and it was so painful. And I've heard people say that, like, in fact, it's the worst way that you can die. Crucifixion is, like, definitively the worst way. And therefore, because it's the worst, because it's so terrible, it's an acceptable and appropriate stand-in and redemption for all the ways in which human beings have suffered. But I have to ask myself if this is true, right? Because the longer I look into it, the history of torture and judicial torturous deaths, it's not quite as long as the history of making bread, but it is no less complicated, creative, or remarkable. It is a marvel of technology, a testimony to the persistence of human ingenuity. It is the result of complicated forces that create government, laws, ironwork, knowledge of anatomy, hot fire, and other technologies. In ancient Greece, in fact, a slave's testimony was admissible to a court of law only if it had been obtained by torture, because slaves could not be trusted to tell the truth under normal circumstances. In the Middle Ages, sorry, I should have warned you guys, some of these are a little gruesome. I think it gets one more that's bad. In the Middle Ages, torture taught important public lessons about staying on the right side of the law. And today, torture is used by the American government and others to obtain what is considered information vital to the greater good. When I consider the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth in the context of this broad scope of history, so when I consider the crucifixion, right, this gruesome, terrible death, it actually loses for me a lot of its sense of uniqueness and miraculousness because it seems so commonplace. This is just what people do to each other. They hurt each other in really terrible ways all the time. But at the same time, the sharing of bread gains a sense of uniqueness and miraculousness when you consider it in the same context. Jesus of Nazareth died in the same way that he was born, commonly, without fanfare, with only the fewest of onlookers to understand and write down what had transpired. Rather than teaching me a cosmic lesson on mercy, justice, the life and death of Jesus Christ reminds me of a simple fact, that human beings will always seek to kill each other in increasingly specific, painful, and gruesome ways. It reminds me of the terrible ways we leverage our abilities, our capacities, and our technologies to gain power over one another and to satisfy our own darkest desires. But on the other hand, the communion, the sharing of bread. The communion reminds me of the miracle of the passing down of knowledge and technology from mother to daughter, father to son, of the beauty of sustenance for ourselves, our families, our friends, and the wonder, most of all, of sharing that sustenance. And here's the thing about transhumanism. Transhumanism reminds me that redemption isn't going to come by default, right? Transhumanism is this idea that if we're going to become, you know, superhuman, if we're going to transcend all this technology that's coming at us, we're going to have to do it with a lot of intention. We're going to have to do it with a lot of foresight and a lot of trust in each other. That, you know, our survival as a species has not ever been guaranteed. For now, we see through a glass darkly. In this age of rapidly expanding possibilities, where diamonds are mined with blood and bombs can melt children's skin, where the chances of us eradicating ourselves increases day by day as technology races to the bottom, it's clear to me that we will hurt each other in increasingly specific and painful ways. But we will also heal each other in increasingly specific and miraculous ways. Like Jesus, we too succumb to the evils of this world, all the while holding out the simplest of offerings, a piece of bread, a drink of wine, a night shared with friends in which we are clothed and warm because of the ingenuity of our ancestors. To me, the cosmic meaning behind this weird and wonderful story of Jesus Christ is not to understand redemption on some vast universal scale. The meaning is this: to understand what my contribution to the success of humanity might be. To create a vitamin pill, to program a comment platform, to run a social media channel, or to innovate virtual reality. These are all the simplest of offerings, inadequate sacramental bread against the dark night of crucifixion. But the miracle of bread and of civilized society was not created in one day. The most powerful stories we have to tell are not the stories of the brief moments when a man is killed, when technology is leveraged for insidious ends. The most powerful stories are about the ways that, despite all odds, humanity persists and humanity is possible, line upon line, innovation upon innovation. The symbol of communion has endured as long as the symbol of the cross. The symbol of communion endures because of the cross, despite the cross, and in rebellion to the cross. And the ultimate meaning of this story, the story of Jesus Christ, is the reminder that the cross has not yet eclipsed the bread. As long as we still exist, there is still a chance that the tide of history may be churned by the smallest of our contributions. We may suffer, we may flail, and we may die. But 30,000 years after my first mother ground root into flour, the cross still has not eclipsed the bread. Thank you.
Okay. So I want to talk about the atonement as an instrumental cause. And to talk about something as an instrumental cause is to talk about its work to bring about an outcome outside of itself. So, for example, to look at a baseball bat as an instrumental cause is we can look to the baseball bat as an instrumental cause for hitting a home run. We're not talking about the quality of the wood or the quality of the craftsmanship. So we're not talking about something that's intrinsic to whatever we're talking about. We're talking about what it can do for something outside of itself. And I'd like to start by reading a section from the poem The Man Watching by Rilke. And I'll return to it again at the end, and hopefully we can read our experience and response to the atonement better for it. What we choose to fight is so tiny. What fights with us is so great. When we win, it's with small things. What is extraordinary and eternal does not want to be bent by us. I mean the angel who appeared to the wrestlers in the Old Testament when the wrestler's sinews grew long like metal strings. He felt them under his fingers like chords of deep music. Whoever was beaten by this angel, who often simply declined the fight, went away proud and strengthened and great from that harsh hand that kneaded him as if to change his shape. Winning does not tempt that man. This is how he grows, by being defeated decisively by successively greater beings. If we approach religion as a tool for promoting the best forms of human activity, which I think is a good way to approach it, we can look at humanity as a trajectory and view the appropriate work of religion as building a bridge between current human activity and God, which God we can conceive of as the full and highest flowering of human potential, morally, creatively, and physically. We can cast this work of bridge building as another religious term, atonement, or bringing humanity at one with God. Through this lens, becoming more like God is the aim of our activity, and the work, any work, by anyone, of bridging the gap between humanity and God is the work of atonement. In this presentation, I propose a practical approach to the atonement of Jesus Christ. I try to demonstrate that this religious idea can inform and elevate moral behavior in ways that resonate with both religious and non-religious people. I argue that Jesus' atonement encourages us to follow his example. It is a call for us to take responsibility for evil and death in the world. The atonement of Jesus Christ is constituted by the acts through which Jesus accounted for the consequences of death and sin or evil. It is the central doctrine of Mormonism and Christianity in general. Exploring the atonement of Jesus Christ as an instrumental cause for human behavior means asking what behaviors the atonement prompts, promotes, and provokes in humans. A basic premise is that religious teachings should promote behaviors that can be appreciated as good by people outside that religious community. This is not to say that there can't also be internal goods that are only specific to that community. So in this case, as the central teaching of Mormonism, we should be able to see how the atonement of Jesus Christ promotes behaviors in Mormons that can be appreciated as good by non-Mormons or by non-Latter-day Saints or members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or just Mormons. So a quick test for this would be to ask, so what behaviors does the atonement prompt, promote, and provoke in Mormons? But here we're pulled up short. The conventional ways we think of the atonement promote attitudes and responses that vary from passive to merely self-centered activity. For example, we point to the atonement as the abstract means through which injustices in the world are resolved. We might say something like, though the world may seem unjust, a loving God has provided a solution. The answer is the atonement. Through the atonement of Jesus Christ, all sins, all disappointment, all suffering, all pain, physical, emotional, psychological, spiritual, all evil is accounted for, and justice will be meted out with perfection. We also point to the atonement as a singular act that demands gratitude and awe. We might say something like, though we can never fully comprehend it, we can begin to appreciate the infinite, incomparable, eternal atonement. It is the critical element of the plan of salvation. Through the atonement, Jesus not only experienced each individual's griefs and pains across time, culture, place, and age, he carried the full weight of all sin, suffering, turmoil, and death from all ages. Theologically speaking, this may be the case. But in terms of the human behavior we're promoting, this is troubling. Because not only is the atonement used as an important-sounding, abstract idea that we can't understand, it could conceivably be and has been invoked as a rationale to not address current evils or injustices in the world. Moreover, it burdens Jesus with the entire weight of evil and death and turns his acts into an object of mystery and worship, which tends to turn us off from doing what we can to counter evils and prompts us to only be grateful and awed. Mr. Davis might think it's okay to not do anything to help people who are starving, even though he can, because the atonement will make things right for these people in the end. I don't think this is an appropriate or good attitude, but it can be a well-meaning attitude and a mechanism to cope with seemingly intractable evils in the world. These responses frequently invoke the horrific suffering of Jesus, as well as adjectives we often hear such as infinite and incomprehensible, that underscore the mysteriousness and singular quality of his atoning work. I'm not arguing that Jesus' atoning work wasn't mysterious or singular, or that his suffering wasn't horrific or worthy of worship. I am arguing that emphasizing these as opposed to acknowledging these tends to weaken its instrumental value for improving our behavior. What we tend to lose in the emphasis on the mystery, incomprehensibility, and singular quality of Jesus' atonement is a vibrant here-and-now response, a response that follows Jesus' example by taking on evil and working to heal the current world. And in terms of its instrumental value in provoking improved human behavior, I'm not sure what we gain. As an instrumental cause, the closest we get is to celebrate that the atonement makes repentance possible. This is probably better than the responses above because it doesn't just call for passively receiving blessings, and it's not just a call for mostly non-physical exercise, but I still find it too self-centered. This response puts the focus on personal change for the better. I need to stop swearing. I need to stop having bad thoughts. I need to be nicer to others. Moreover, this response has more fundamental shortcomings, as I'll discuss next. In short, there are bigger fish to fry. In general, the way we teach the atonement, it is a weak instrumental cause, or more accurately, the responses we encourage are weak or unfit the atonement. Due to fixations on personal sin rather than evil in the world, a future life after death, and the singular role of Jesus to solve death and evil. A fixation on personal sin rather than evil feels like a privileged perspective. Analogously, it feels like being inspired by someone who tirelessly fought for homeless people and responding by making sure that you're not homeless instead of continuing his fight for them. And a fixation on a future life after death is essentially abstract and tends to devalue this life and possible work that could improve conditions in the present. And a fixation on the singular role of Jesus to solve death and evil may unduly relinquish burdens that belong to us to resolve what portion of evil and death we can. By continually referencing the singular role of Jesus' atonement work, we discount, delay, and diminish our own. We build it up as an idol that tends to weaken us. We shift the burden of justifying evil wholly onto his shoulders, or push that justification off to some future day when God will take care of everything. If we are to reference it and grant it the appropriate weight but not get fixed on it, we could say something like this. Because of the atonement of Jesus Christ, the responsibility is now clearly and squarely on us to heal the world. Not because of the atonement of Jesus Christ, we can rest assured that any evils and injustices will be perfectly addressed by a loving God. That's not very far from, because of the atonement of Jesus Christ, we can be justified in not addressing evil and rest assured knowing that the injustices and evil we recognize will be addressed somehow in a future day by God. That is a weak, or more precisely, an evil complicit response. And I can imagine God responding to such an attitude with words like these. You thought I was going to take care of all the evil and injustices? Whose test did you think this was? The turn from a conception of atonement reflected in these fixations to one that is focused on promoting better responses can be designated as a turn from worshiping to practicing atonement. Though we can do both when we shift our focus to practice, the atonement of Jesus Christ can become an instrumental cause that provides a model for improving our behavior toward each other and our outlook on the gap between humanity and God. In terms of the behaviors it should prompt in us, I would argue that the central characteristics of Jesus' atonement are he took responsibility for evil and death in the world. He didn't actually admit that he was to blame for these, but he suffered or went through the process of making amends for them. And part of this was an acknowledgement that this is what God wanted and expected him to do, even if he didn't necessarily feel inclined to or intuitively feel like he was obligated to pay this price. As an instrumental cause, the atonement of Jesus Christ should motivate us to follow his example by taking responsibility for evil and death in the world to the degree that we can, and recognize that our ability to take more responsibility is continually increasing as our physical, moral, and technological horizons expand. To clarify this interpretation of the atonement, consider an example on the opposite end of the spectrum. Hannah Arendt writes a troubling case of such an example in Eichmann in Jerusalem. The case is the trial of Adolf Eichmann, a leader in the Nazi German army who directed mass killings during the Holocaust. But Eichmann didn't see himself as responsible for the evil and death he carried out under his orders. He was just following higher orders, doing his job in the context of a bureaucracy. So we have two opposing examples. On the one hand, we have Jesus, not to blame for evil or death in the world, yet taking full responsibility. And on the other, we have Eichmann, directly responsible, directly to blame for evil and death, yet stubbornly resisting accepting responsibility. My interpretation is that the central message of the atonement as an instrumental cause is that we should follow the example of Jesus, not Eichmann. As humans, yeah, that's a relief, right? As humans, we are at least complicit on much more evil than we might typically imagine. What might it look like for us to take responsibility for evil? For starters, consider some examples of evil that we are, by virtue of being adults in the world, to some degree complicit. It is evil that genocide has been conducted, even in recent years. It is evil that people are trafficked and enslaved. It is evil that we do activities that facilitate these, even unknowingly, or don't do activities that would thwart them. When I think of these situations, I feel the burden of some of the most poignant verses in Scripture, calling us from any person or people whom we kill or make suffer, even unknowingly, or through our inaction allow to be killed or suffer today. The first is from the Pearl of Great Price. In these verses, the prophet Enoch is surprised to witness the Lord weeping, and he asks how this can be. And Enoch said unto the Lord, "How is it that thou canst weep?" The Lord said unto Enoch, "Behold, these thy brethren, I gave unto them their knowledge. And in the Garden of Eden gave I unto man his agency. And unto thy brethren have I said, and also given commandment, that they should love one another. But behold, they are without affection, and they hate their own blood." The second is the famous response from Cain upon killing his brother Abel, and the Lord's response to Cain. And the Lord said unto Cain, "Where is Abel thy brother?" And he said, "I know not. Am I my brother's keeper?" And he said, "What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." In these verses, I read a God chastising the standpoint of not taking responsibility for evil. His chastising takes the form of bewilderment, that humans somehow miss that we all belong to each other and have a claim on each other's love and affection. Beyond these passages, this interpretation of the atonement consummates Jesus' response to evil and death as having the moral high ground even to his teachings on the Sermon on the Mount. The full renunciation of the violence and evil condoned in an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, is not turn the other cheek, but take responsibility for evil. Make a world with fewer lost eyes and teeth. Even for non-Mormons or even non-religious people, this reading of the atonement of Jesus Christ offers a behavioral model with a moral high ground to any competing models I can conceive of. Typical religious responses to the atonement of Jesus Christ tend to be shallow or self-serving. Rather than taking up in a serious way Jesus' work to overcome evil and death, we comfort ourselves by pointing to the progress we've made with our bad mouth, addictions, or selfishness. Or we call upon Jesus to help because we're not progressing well enough on those fronts. Indeed, as Rilke writes, what we fight is so tiny, when we win, the triumph itself makes us small. An initial portrait of practicing atonement could take many faces, but possible starting points could be to do whatever work we can against human trafficking, starvation, etc. These aren't new issues, but we haven't been good at seeing a religious obligation to take these on. Our starting point could take a local or global tack, but in any case, our responsibility for evil and death extends at least as far as all of humanity. We won't resolve evil and death in a week or a year. These are big, awful monsters that will defeat our efforts decisively for some time to come. But taking on such monsters is how we grow, and we can take inspiration from Jesus and accept responsibility for them, and trust that our ability to take on great monsters is our heritage and destiny, and will improve and expand as we practice atonement. In fact, as our technological, moral, and physical horizons expand, this work becomes increasingly clear, and the gap between earth and the kingdom of God, or humanity and God, can be seen as measurably closing. Certainly, until we become gods, this work will require radically expanded creativity and compassion. It will involve numerous scientific discoveries, transcendent surprises, technological breakthroughs, and an abundance of grace. When we completely fill the gap, our religious aims will be realized. Faith will have fulfilled its role as a tool for bridging the gap between humanity and God. And if we haven't realized before, we will then, that is the worthy earth, kingdom, community, humanity, post-humanity, science, technology, art, religion, and post-religion we've been working toward all along. Thank you.
Should go offline?
Yeah, unless you have a video at all?
No.
Yeah,
there were a couple of flashes.
Yeah, there's a storm going over us.
Yeah. Good thing I printed out my presentation.
Does it not look in there on the tab? Can I try that?
In the drive here?
Yeah,
it looks like I'm disconnected.
See, we're like technologists. We're like proving to you. Like,
yeah.
Yep.
I mean, did you try it up here?
So these are not mine. This one was mine, and it just died. So.
Hey, I want to read this before while I got your guys' attention, okay? We'd like to thank Ben Blair, Mike Langardner Bradley, Caleb Jones, and Dallin Bradford, who's going to do his thing, and the Mormon Transhumanist Association for sponsoring this presentation. Mormon transhumanists work to carefully consider the possibility of post-humanity and its scientific, moral, and religious implications. Please visit their booth across the hall to meet with a representative, join, or learn more about Mormon transhumanism.
It kind of gets crazy at the end there, and I wanted to get that message of theirs out while I had everybody's attention.
I'm tethering. See if it works. Well, I didn't print out the slides. I printed off all my words. Okay. Let's see. It looks like Greenwood is connected again. So let's try it. Looks like we're back. Great. Thanks very much. All right, my name is Dallin Bradford. I am the Humanitarian and Membership Director for the MTA. I'm also what I like to call a second-generation Mormon transhumanist. My dad was one of the founders, and so this organization has really heavily informed my theology as I've grown up, and it continues to do so since I'm still growing up. So Mormon transhumanists are a really diverse bunch. We have many different breeds of Mormon throughout our membership and many different breeds of other religious and non-affiliated people throughout our membership. Because of this, we have lots of opinions on lots of topics. We have, however, managed to come up with a few unifying beliefs that we all affirm. So we have the Mormon Transhumanist Affirmation and the Transhumanist Declaration. I'm going to go through the Mormon Transhumanist Affirmation, and you can look up the Transhumanist Declaration or pick up a copy of both of them at our booth. One, we are disciples of Jesus Christ, of the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is to trust in, change toward, and fully immerse our bodies and minds in the role of Christ to become compassionate creators, as exemplified and invited by Jesus. Two, we understand the gospel to be compatible with and complementary to many religions and philosophies, particularly those that provoke strenuous pursuit of compassionate and creative exaltation. Three, we seek the spiritual and physical exaltation of individuals and their anatomies, as well as communities and their environments, according to their wills, desires, and laws, to the extent they are not oppressive. We believe that scientific knowledge and technological power are among the means ordained of God to enable such exaltation, including realization of diverse prophetic visions of transfiguration, immortality, resurrection, renewal of this world, and the discovery and creation of worlds without end. We feel a duty to use science and technology according to wisdom and inspiration, to identify and prepare for risks and responsibilities associated with future advances, and to persuade others to do likewise. We practice our discipleship when we offer friendship, that all may be many in one. When we receive truth, let it come from whence it may, and when we send relief, consolation, and healing that raises each other together. Every member of the MTA affirms these words, as well as the Transhumanist Declaration. We believe in this stuff. The MTA's purpose is to promote the Transhumanist Declaration and the Mormon Transhumanist Affirmation, and with good reason. Imagine the future we propose, an end to violence, fear, and death, replaced by resurrection, atonement, and infinitely increasing knowledge, power, joy, and love. I've been inspired, and I share this stuff with my family and my friends often. It's exciting to talk about the future in this way, and to draw connections between science and religion, but it doesn't end there. To what end do we preach? Why do we invite others to come partake of the MTA? Why is the mission of the MTA to promote these ideas? It is so that we will live by them, persuade others to do likewise, and together build Zion. In our view, the gospel cannot be passively received, or it would never be fulfilled. Our view of prophecy is not simply foretelling, but forthtelling. We believe that we should strive to bring about our hopes. We should be anxiously engaged in a good cause. As Don Bradley, one of our board members and founders, said, I think he's a founder, is he? Pretty sure. No, never mind, he's not. That's his wife correcting me. As Don Bradley said, if you are eager for the work of exaltation, of creating worlds, you need not wait. It begins here. Of course, it will begin with small and simple things, but we will go on to work miracles. We live in an exciting time with advances in science and technology and new rises in religion. Things once defined as miracles are now within our grasp and are understood by children. We are not far from living in a world of artificial general intelligence, affordable genetic editing, and augmented reality. We have a ways to go on our trek to Zion, but with the destination in mind, it's only a matter of time before we see miracles take place. To build a city of Zion, populated by a post-human body of Christ, we need to develop in knowledge, power, and love as a community. So what stands between you or me and the divine potential we've yet to realize? Perhaps it is a higher standard of health, or a more thorough education, or an increase in charity. What stands between the other people of this world and their divine potential yet to be realized? Perhaps it is a higher standard of health, or a more thorough education, or an increase in charity. We will not fulfill our discipleships without taking steps together to Godward. Now, the MTA is best suited for advocacy. We don't have the structure to directly address the problems of the world. It'll take a much larger effort to wrestle with the monsters of today and those of tomorrow. In Embracing a Radiant Mormonism, Richard Bushman suggests that the biggest impact the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has had is in the influence of its members. The contributions they've made in business, scholarship, philanthropy, technology, and the arts are vast and varied. I think we can apply this to ourselves and perhaps, being more conscious of the phenomenon, better apply it. We all have different strengths and weaknesses and different approaches to building Zion. Some of us may feel a little less suited to the task than others. I think our diversity is something we can really be proud of and maybe even put to use. Look around you. There are engineers, professors, students, parents, programmers, writers, activists, and artists. The future is going to depend on how we use our skills, time, and resources. I found a few things that could help us get started in earnest as we try to bring about our idea of Zion. The first one is study. Become familiar with religious and transhumanist ideas and with the important conversations that are going on right now all around us. Look into the transhumanist community and see what efforts are already being made to solve the problems most significant to you. Imagine in specific ways what Zion or heaven would look like if you had a hand in designing it, and then start working towards that. Share. Engage in important dialogue. Invite others to study as you have. Write blogs, comments, letters to government officials, books and articles. Make artwork and music. Talk about this stuff in the home, at work, at school, and church. I think many of us are doing pretty well here. Serve. There are many opportunities to serve, for the short and long term, for the skilled or the unskilled. There are many causes where your time is far more valuable than your money. Especially here in Utah, Just Serve is a great option. There are many others. There are hundreds of opportunities within 10 miles of Salt Lake City alone. Additionally, you can filter them to find projects that let you use your skills and talents. Our service to the world is the most communicable and relatable of our good qualities. I think this is an area in which many of us could stand to improve. Work. Put your righteous desires and talents and tenacity to use. We have such potential in this community for good work. I found an organization called 80,000 Hours that offers career coaching and planning, so that you can have the biggest impact to the causes you believe in through your work. They also have a job board listing several openings around the world in organizations for interns, research fellows, developers, engineers, managers, etc., that you could fill. We could contribute to policy, government, technological advancement, education, literature, and art in remarkable, world-shifting ways if we put our minds to it. Give. Many of the advances of technology we all enjoy have yet to reach many people around the world. Additionally, research into many potential existential risks need funding. There is a fear that the future will be bleak for those who are already behind. I say that the best way to prepare for and prevent the dystopian futures we dread is to live with charity today. We should demonstrate to the world the promise of advanced technology by showing the blessings wrought by today's tools. There are ways that we can influence countless lives. We should be examples of thoughtful, liberal giving. To learn how to give well, I'd recommend looking into a movement called Effective Altruism. It's made up of groups that encourage giving to the most effective and efficient causes around the world. They also promote an altruistic, forward-thinking lifestyle. So giving what we can has calculators to help you determine how much you could give based on your income and your tax situation, and what kind of an impact your donations could have for different causes. And some impressive causes include deworming a child for 50 cents and a sight-giving surgery for $50. The Center for Effective Altruism has a great donation page with detailed descriptions of each cause they recommend, and many of these causes are existential risk prevention. Reasons for and against donating to different causes can also be found on their websites, and a tool to help you divide your donation between causes. On The Life You Can Save, you can try giving, where you decide a percentage of your income that you're willing to give and how long you will commit to giving that. You can also sign the pledge to give at least 10% of your income in perpetuity to the causes you believe will have the biggest impact. These suggestions are not novel, and my list is not exhaustive. There are so many ways that we can start practicing atonement with our brothers and sisters and parents and children. My prayer is that every action taken, every word spoken, and every wish held will be with the vision of this peculiar people in mind. We are to fulfill prophecy, save ourselves with all our dead, and build Zion. If we are to redeem ourselves with all our dead, fulfill prophecy, and redeem and build Zion, then we must practice our discipleship. Mormon transhumanists affirm a duty to expand the work of Christ before us with what means we have, to realize greater means to even greater works. In this lone and dreary world, our hands are stretched out still. We reach to the prodigal, the blind, the mute, the deaf, the lame, the poor, the sick, the imprisoned, the alien, the fearful, the forgotten, even the dead. It is possible that years from now, when we awake from our sleep of death, the hands that raise us will be familiar. When they embrace us and say, "Come, ye blessed of our fathers and mothers, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For we were hungered, and ye gave us meat. We were thirsty, and ye gave us drink. We were strangers, and ye took us in. Naked, and ye clothed us. We were sick, and ye visited us. We were in prison, and ye came unto us." We will recognize our redeemers as the children of those we lifted. Thank you.
Okay, if you have any questions, you can step up to the microphone up there. All righty. Thank you.
I'll just make a plug for the Bountiful Children's Foundation. They have a booth also, and help a malnourished child grow to become a productive adult today. So this goes in line with what Dallin was talking about. There's a booth there. And again, if you're interested in learning more or talking with any of us or another representative of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, our booth is across the hall, and we'll be here. We still have some time if people have questions or if you want to just hang out and mingle.
All of them are related, but I'll focus on you, Ben. What do you make of as a lot of Christians would call it, the event of Jesus' atonement? Is there any, within your transhumanist LDS view, is there any emanation from that event that is not simply psychological, quote, well, I take the word back. Simply is, for psychological is a bad word. It is not a psychological response to hearing about it. In other words, do you have to hear about it for it to make a difference in your life? And if so, have we not got an atonement that's really going to be the business of the spirit world and not here? Billions and billions of people have never heard, especially not an LDS idea of atonement. How do you work with that idea?
I can try. I'm not sure.
I mean, the answer is that, like, you answered yourself. I mean, isn't that the point of Mormon gospel, that, like, you have to hear it? Yeah. Sorry. I mean, I'm totally jumping. Sorry, Ben. I'm totally jumping in on your thing. But, I mean, I feel like Randy kind of answered it. I mean, that, like, I mean, the whole point of the LDS theology is that you have to hear it. So I'm not quite sure I understand, like, the conflict. I mean,
I think also Ben did not specifically address what the atonement is intrinsically, like what it is by nature. He more critiqued the typical response that we give to the atonement, which is usually too passive. And he argues that we should start surmounting larger evils rather than worry about cursing and our fasting habits and those kinds of things. We should really start looking at things, like he was saying, human trafficking, and really reconciling those big issues. And so I don't know, he said that, you know, theologically it may be the case that there is this massive, powerful effect from Christ's atonement, but he argued that the response that we give is a little bit shallow.
And I would also say, this is kind of my default response for a lot of these things, is the proof is in the pudding. So when we are atoned with God, however that happens, whether some event that happened 2,000 years ago played an essential role or not, it doesn't matter until we are atoned, until we're at one with God. Or it hasn't. That will be the realization of whatever efforts went into it. Yeah, I'll take that, but I would kind of envelop that in the proof is in the pudding. So whenever it happens,
yeah. Thanks for your presentation. Just curious, a couple quick things. What's the relationship of the Mormon Transhumanist Association to the kind of general transhumanist stuff that you presented a bit on? Are you a chapter of the?
So transhumanism is like a philosophical concept.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So you have like Humanity Plus. I think you have a particular organization, or?
Yeah. So I went to the Humanity Plus. Oh, cool. And it said to start your own chapter, and then I wondered if.
Yeah. So we are affiliated with them, but we're not like a chapter of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we have had like speakers of theirs like at our conference.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so there's other transhumanist organizations probably as well.
Yeah. Right? So like, for example, like it's actually the Christian Transhumanist Association.
Oh, okay.
Like a sister organization of ours. Like we share resources sometimes, but there's no formal or legal connection. And actually, if you go on our YouTube channel, you can see like Liz Parrish or like Aubrey de Grey. Like we've had them at our conference if you want to ever check those out.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great.
And I would also say, and this is where I feel like the Mormon Transhumanist Association has some weight in environments outside of Mormonism. So the example, and it's not a well-developed argument, but the example would be if Incan and Mayan scholarship were this going concern, and top scholars in Incan and Mayan scholarship were routinely pointing to Mormon Incan and Mayan scholarships and going, wow, what the Mormon Incan and Mayan scholarships are talking about, we really need to listen to. They're really engaging in this in important ways. And I feel like, and if they were also saying, and if those Mormon Incan and Mayan scholarships were unabashedly embracing their Mormonism and saying, yeah, we definitely come about this through a Mormon lens, and if that was the case and this scholarship, Incan Mayan scholarship, was taking that seriously and really engaging it, I feel like that's kind of what's happening in transhumanism. That the Mormon Transhumanist Association isn't looked at as, here's this wild, off, crazy religious people talking about humanism. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, Lincoln Cannon, who's here, has some great publications. He has some street cred. When I randomly ran into Aubrey de Grey, which I don't know if you're familiar with him, he's probably the leading scholar on life extension. And I told him that I was with the Mormon Transhumanist Association. He was super excited. He said, oh, what they're doing is really exciting, and right along with what's happening in transhumanism. So it's kind of a rare thing, especially in a conference like this.
Yeah. And are your efforts, like the Bountiful efforts and the things that you're doing worldwide, that's in association with other organizations, or that's only through the Mormon Transhumanist?
You mean like humanitarian efforts?
Yeah, and such.
I mean, I can take it. Yeah, so we have done lots of efforts through other organizations. We've partnered up with different people to like sponsor yeah. schools and a couple of other things, and like computer labs and that kind of stuff. And we've recently started trying to revamp as we've kind of grown as an organization. We're trying to find other outlets as well that we can directly sponsor.
I see. Okay.
And so right now, I'd say that most of our efforts have been through partnerships with other organizations, but we're looking at potential for handling other kinds of efforts. I would say that it's important to keep in mind that the MTA officially is more of an advocacy network, and so it's likely that we will probably do most of our work in partnership with yeah. others, okay. and then encouraging individuals to go on and continue their efforts on whatever they consider important.
Great. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other? Okay. There we go.
I realize this might be a little bit off topic, but your discussion about the Atonement in particular made me think about this, which you kind of tried to recast the Atonement as a thing we should actively participate in our lives and with people around us. And how do you analogize that to the LDS practice of going to the temple so often, where we're participating in the salvation of the dead? Is that consistent with your view of the Atonement, while we might be spending so much time in the temple that we're ignoring the living? Or how do you kind of balance that, and how do you think about that?
Well, I think that gets to the idea of communicable goods. So that would be something that it's hard to talk to someone outside of Mormonism about the importance of doing temple work. But it's not hard to talk to someone outside of Mormonism about the other types of humanitarian work we're talking about. So it's not to say that's bad. It's bad to do temple work. It's just saying that's not communicable to others.
And I think, like, part of, I mean, speaking a little bit for Ben here, but I think one of the most important things for me that I hear Ben saying is that it's really important that we don't become almost self-focused on, like, self-purity, right? But that we're outwardly churned. It's so much more motivating to think about how is me tapping into the Atonement going to make it other people's lives easier. And I think, you know, if you are devout or Orthodox or still, like, church pew Mormon, the temple is a fantastic way to exhibit or experience that kind of outward turning, right? I am being religiously devotional for things that have no benefit to me personally whatsoever. And if you're not devout, if you're not a church pew Mormon, I think it's incredibly wonderful to not forget about ancestors and descendants, because I do see a lot of sort of like neoliberal, I mean, like, there's some of this sort of talk about, like, leaving the earth for, like, our children or whatever, but it lacks that, like, Mormon aesthetic, right, of, like, being tuned into the change of chains of generations, right? And so I think we can't, I think from LDS Atonement perspective, we can't lose sight of the power of that.
I just have a little bit to add as well. I think that the important thing when it comes to this approach to Atonement is that when we go to the temple, if you're a church pew Mormon, you should not just be going for yourself, right? You do that the first time that you go through, but then the rest of the time, really, you are trying to focus on the work for the others, right? But I think I know that I've certainly been guilty of this. I'm a church pew Mormon, and I think that I've gone to the temple for my own sake far more often than I have gone with the idea that I'm going in to redeem the dead. I think that that's something that I share in common with a lot of people. And I'm not to say that I don't keep that in mind, but I think that the emphasis is in the wrong place. Right? Like, I go to the temple when I'm having a spiritual crisis or something. I go to the temple when I have a question. Or I go to the temple when just because it's routine or something. But I think that the motivation behind it should be changed. And there's a lot to be said that our greatest good can be done if we're focusing on people who are not alive now, right? So from a traditional LDS perspective, that is works for the dead, right? Because it's a pretty fast way to do a fair bit of good, right? If you believe all of the doctrine, right? And then on the other side of things, effective altruism argues that a lot of the best good can be done if you're investing in things where you won't see an immediate payoff, but if you can tackle something like global warming, you could be saving potentially billions of people's lives by contributing to a cause where you won't save anybody today, and you won't necessarily solve somebody's hunger crisis or enable somebody today, but you could be improving drastically the life standard of generations to come. And so if we're thinking generations back and generations to come, there's a lot of room for good to be done. But I think that it's more that we need to make sure that our focus is on others, is on the you and the us, instead of on the me.
Okay. One quick thing is, I'll let you do that. This session is about the near and distant future of faith. I would say the near future of faith, I think we need to be have more communicable goods. That if we're doing things that we feel are really important, but no one else believes that they're important outside of our religious community, it's going to be hard to grow and be sustaining.
And I just want to be really clear really quick, too, that a lot of transhumanists actually do believe that they do like cryonics, right, which is that we can actually literally resurrect the dead using science. And so that's where a lot of Mormon theology around ancestors comes into play, because there's an alignment between like actual literal resurrection, if it's not something you're aware of.
I think our time's up.